Mercedes-Benz was the company who first produced a car body that absorbed the force of a collision on impact. And there was a Mercedes-Benz TV commercial that showed the car running into a concrete wall and showing the effects of this brand new design, that the car absorbed the collision impact and the driver could walk away unharmed. Since then, of course, many other companies have taken that idea on. I remember a few years ago, Volvo used to do a very similar type of advert. But someone said to one of the spokesmen from Mercedes-Benz, why didn't you enforce the patent on that design? Why have you allowed other car companies to steal it? And the director from Mercedes-Benz simply said, because some things in life are too important not to share. Some things in life are too important not to share. And how true that is, not just about cars, but the message of Christianity, the message of Jesus Christ. It is such important news, too important not to share. The Apostle Paul was the first person who kind of travelled widely with the sharing with the gospel of Jesus Christ. He's considered the first missionary. The word missionary just means someone who is sent out. And of course, we've often said you are either a missionary or a mission field. If you are a Christian, you are a missionary. Wherever you go during this next week, you take with you the gospel of Jesus and you demonstrate it by life and by lip to those we encounter. And if you're not a Christian, you're the mission field waiting to be reached. And Paul was the first person who not only went local, but he went further afield. And in the book of Acts, we read of three missionary journeys. We've read and already studied the first one. Acts chapters 13 to 14 is Paul's first missionary journey. It lasted about 2 years. We're currently studying the second missionary journey. That's Acts chapter 16, 17 and 18. And that would last for about 3 years. And then in a few weeks' time, when we look at his third missionary journey, that's Acts chapter 19, 20 and 21. And that final trip would last about 5 years. But Paul heard the great commission of Jesus, and he went to all people, all nations, with this gospel message. And of course, you and I, as his followers, are called to do the same, to share this message with those we encounter. And the test to find out whether your mission on earth has finished or not is simple. If you're alive, it hasn't finished. All of us, till promoted to glory, are missionaries, either local or further afield. We are sent out with the gospel of Jesus. And in Acts chapter 17, we're travelling with Paul on his second missionary journey. After teaching some in Berea, you looked at that last week, he has departed ahead of his team workers, his friends, his co-workers, Silas and Timothy. He lands in Athens, maybe to spend the winter there during the year of AD 51 to 52. And I want to divide the passage into a number of headings. Number one, Athens, a city of extremes. That's verses 16 to 22. Athens, a city of extremes. For centuries, Athens had been the cradle, the birthplace of democracy and education. It had been home to some of the great philosophers, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, the great intellects, the great thinkers. Although someone has said, you know how many philosophers it takes to change a light bulb? Let me help you out. According to Socrates, a light bulb unexamined, it's not worth changing. According to Plato, there is no need to change the light bulb because the only true light is knowledge. According to Aristotle, first we misunderstand what we mean by change. And according to Epicurus, we must consider whether changing the light bulb will bring pleasure or pain before we decide to change it or not. Now they, of course, have got their own back on us. Because you know how many Christians it takes to change a light bulb. If you don't, let me help you. Charismatics, one. After all, they've already got their hands in the air, haven't they? Pentecostal, 10. One to change the light bulb and 9 to pray against the spirit of darkness. Reformed, None. Lights will go on and off at predestined times. Roman Catholics, none. Candles only. Baptist, at least 15, one to change the light bulb and three committees to approve the change. Anglicans, it takes three. One to call the electrician, one to make the tea, and one to talk about how better the old light bulb was. Christian Brethren, none. What do you mean, change? Well, Athens was a city of extremes. For centuries, like I said, it was the cradle of democracy, the birthplace of education. And it had these famous philosophers like Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. But what an extreme city it was. On one hand, the intellectuals, the brains. But it was a city full of idols. How primitive they were, by way of contrast. In fact, even their own historians talk about how many idols dominated this intellectual city. I suppose, as Blaise Pascal once said, within every human heart is a God-shaped hole, waiting to be filled. It cannot be filled by created things. It can only be filled by God. And we only know him through Jesus Christ. And here was an entire city, a showcase of past intellectual achievement, and yet a real hunger for spiritual reality and spiritual satisfaction. And in verse 16, the Apostle Paul looks around this city, and it is full of idols. It disturbed, it broke his very soul. According to the commentator Lenski, their own writers mocked them for the amount of idols. Petronius sarcastically remarked, "In Athens, it is easier to find a god than to find a man." That's how many idols there were around the city. Pausanias said, "Athens has more images than the whole of Greece put together." And Xenophon wrote, "Athens, one great altar, one great offering to the gods." So here's a city of contrast. On one hand, the brains, the intellects, the educated. On the other hand, the primitive, those who bow down to silver, to gold, to stone, who worship their creation of their own imaginations. Athens, a city of extremes. Secondly, you've got Paul, a man of courage, verses 17 to 22. Paul, a man of courage. Verse 17 says, "He reasoned in the synagogue with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to debate with him. Some of them asked, 'What is this babbler trying to say?' Others remarked, 'He seems to be advocating foreign gods.' They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. They actually thought he was talking about two gods, Jesus and another god called resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to the meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, 'May we know this new teaching that you are presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we would like to know what they mean.' All the Athenians and foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to great ideas." If you go to Edinburgh, in St. Giles, the old town, there is a stone, and it has two initials on it, JK. It's got nothing to do with Harry Potter and JK Rowling, but a great Christian from history, a man called John Knox. And I don't know if it's true or if it's just legend, but they say his dust resumes under that stone. And John Knox was a clergyman, a leader of the Protestant Reformation, who brought new life into the Church of Scotland. He was a great Christian, a great courageous Christian, and a great man of prayer. It is said that Mary, Queen of Scots, trembled at the very thought of John Knox on his knees. And at one time she exclaimed publicly, she feared Knox's prayers more than any army in Europe. And when the Regent Morton saw John Knox laid in the grave, he exclaimed, "There lies he who never feared the face of man." John Knox was a man of courage. The Apostle Paul, similar, was a man of courage. Even without his team of helpers, verse 16 says, he's left them behind. Luke is in Philippi. Silas and Timothy are still coming from Berea. He's on his own, but he doesn't wait for support. He's going to make a stand for Jesus on his own, courageously. He goes into the synagogue and then into the marketplace to debate Christian things. And the Apostle Paul has a threefold strategy here. First, in the synagogue. That was always where Paul started. Whenever he went to a city or a village, as was his habit, he would reason. Why? Because he knew, first of all, he would get a hearing. He was amongst his own people, fellow Jews. They knew the scriptures. They had common ground. And so he started with those who would welcome him and give him a favourable opportunity to speak for Jesus. But when he moves into the marketplace and then into this debating chamber, he changes. His whole style of evangelism changes. Do you know why? Because there is no one size fits all when it comes to evangelism. Different people have to be reached in different ways. And we have an expression, don't we? Horses for courses. The biblical expression would be by any means necessary. Remember when I used to go on beach teams, it was run by an organisation called BAM, Gospel Trust. And the BAM stood for by any means. And they took it from 1 Corinthians 9, verses 19 to 20, where Paul said he became all things to all people that he might win some. And he did it for the sake of the gospel. And so when he was amongst Jews, he reached them in a way that was appealing to Jewish people. When he was amongst Gentiles, he reached them in a way that was appealing to Gentiles. So in the synagogue, he did what the Jews understood. He opened up the Old Testament scriptures. He taught from the Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah they were waiting for. But in the marketplace, very different. Because here's a whole new group of people who have no Jewish scriptures, who don't know them. And they need a different approach if they're going to understand the gospel. And the marketplace provides the perfect platform for a wider audience. The local Athenians mix and mingle. They may be shopping for the latest fashion or for the latest philosophies, but Paul is there with the gospel. In the marketplace, day by day, with those who happened to be there. And there were two groups of thinkers that he encountered in the marketplace. Epicureans and Stoics. Epicureans and Stoics. If you want to know what they believed, Google them. I did actually write out, and then it was so dry and dull, I thought, I'm not going to talk about that. So you can Google it or get a dictionary yourself and find out. But the point is this, they were poles apart in their beliefs about life and the afterlife. These two groups. I suppose we would say they're a bit like Christians and Muslims. Poles apart in lots of things they believe. Philosophers. Philosophy just means you pursue wisdom, and in your pursuit of wisdom it affects how you live. That's philosophy. You have a particular set of beliefs, and those beliefs affect how you live in your pursuit for wisdom and for God. And in verse 18, Paul captures the attentions of the Epicureans and the Stoics. These learned men, although they call him in verse 18 a babbler. The word literally means a seed picker. They said, Paul, you're like a little bird. You pick up a seed here and then you fly somewhere and you drop it. And then you pick up a seed here and you fly somewhere and you drop it. All you do is pick up seeds of information. The contrast, we've got whole plants. We know it all. You're a babbler. You're a seed picker. But we've not heard these ideas before. Come along and expand them. And so he goes from the synagogue to the marketplace, thirdly, to the Areopagus. The Areopagus, or we could call it Mars Hill, the Greek name. It's a lot easier to say, isn't it? It's simply a bare marble hill next to the Acropolis in Athens. And they loved to debate and listen. I love verse 21. All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about listening about the latest ideas. Hey, it was a tough life for men in those days. You had to go to the Areopagus and just talk all day long while the women and the servants did the menial stuff. Tough life, but somebody had to do it. But Paul, the wise, courageous preacher, stood up on his own, undaunted, and preached this sermon that we've already read. He grabs the opportunity, and he speaks eloquently and clearly. And that's the third point. Communication, a message of impact. Verses 16 to 34. Communication, a message of impact. I like the story of the preacher who was wired with a lapel mic. A bit like the old one we used to have down here. It was tied. You clipped it on, and as you walked, it was forever kind of getting in your way, and you were tripping over it. And this was a really kind of energetic preacher who'd wave his hands around and be full of enthusiasm. And he kept tripping over this jolly mic. And one nervous little child in the front row turned to her mum and said, "Mum, if he gets loose, will he bite us?" Well, the Apostle Paul was let loose to preach. And it's a brief address, but every one of these words counts. And there are five factors in his sermon that are worth noting. Number one, he started where they were. Verse 22b to 23a. He started where they were. "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar to the unknown God." Just in case you'd missed the God, you built an extra altar for him. He didn't start with the Old Testament like in the synagogue. He didn't even start with Jesus Christ. His audience knew of neither. He started on common ground, and then he built a bridge of truth from where they were to where he wanted to take them. That's communication. Secondly, he used the familiar to introduce the unfamiliar. That's verse 23b to 24a. "So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship. And this is what I'm going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth." To these Athenians, despite their idols, the true God was unknown. And Paul makes the fact he's unknown, but he is knowable. And with all the care of an architectural engineer, he was methodically constructing a bridge that would span the gap of their ignorance and bring in the truth of Jesus Christ. Thirdly, notice, he developed his theme forcibly and clearly, verse 24b to 28a. He developed his theme forcibly and clearly. Again, speaking in terms they could understand. This God does not live in temples built by hands. He is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. "From one man he made all nations, so they should inhabit the whole earth. And he marked out their appointed times in history, the boundaries of their lands. And God did this so they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being." Just in those couple of verses, he makes four clear truths about the God of heaven. First, God is the creator. Therefore, he cannot be contained. You've got plenty of shrines, you've got plenty of temples, but they're all useless. Second, God is the originator. He has no needs, verse 25. You can't give to God anything. It's the very opposite. God gives us everything we need. Thirdly, God being intelligent has a definite plan, verse 26 and 27. He's in control. And then fourthly, he's the sustainer. God is not dependent on anything. We're dependent on him. And how true that is. even this day, we are creatures who are so dependent, aren't we? Dependent on water, on food, on medication, on friendship, companionship. We're dependent on shelter. We're dependent on the elements. We depend on oxygen. We depend on 101 things for life, but not God. He depends on no one. He's quite unique. The next truth he tells them, he starts where they are. He uses the familiar to introduce the unfamiliar. He develops his theme forcibly and clearly. Fourthly, the Apostle Paul kept their attention with relevant illustrations. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Illustrations are like windows that let the light in. If you didn't have any windows in this building, it would be dark and gloomy. Now, you don't want a whole church made out of windows, otherwise you're a greenhouse, you become fragile. And the light would be too much, there'd be no substance. So you have it made out of something solid, but you punctuate it by light, by windows. And a sermon has to be punctuated by light, by illustrations, to recapture people's attentions, to help them understand. And because these truths were unfamiliar, Paul helped them to understand them with illustrations. He quotes from their own poets. I suppose it's a bit like me saying, you remember in Shakespeare and Romeo and Juliet, and all of a sudden you're, hopefully, images come to mind. Instead of nodding off, you might just stay a little bit longer listening to what's being said. And he quotes from Aratus, a Greek poet, who also said, God is your creator. And he says, look, even your own poets believed in a creator God. And he takes them from what their poet said and he turns it. Because the poet he quotes from is about Zeus. And Paul says, actually, it's not Zeus who's the creator. It's the God of the Bible, the God of the Jews, the God of the Hebrews, who has a son, Jesus Christ. And then fifthly, he applies the message personally. Verse 29, 31. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, he goes on to say that one day everyone will stand before God. Not only is God your creator, he says in verse 29 to 31, he's also your church. And our actions, our lifestyles today, will impact beyond the grave where the resurrected Jesus awaits. Now, this last truth is a major stumbling block between Paul and the Greek philosophers. They had a daily motto which said this: once a man dies and the earth drinks up his blood, there is no resurrection. They didn't believe in a physical resurrection. And here's this itinerant preacher, this lecturer, telling them, not only is there a resurrection, but there's also a judgment to follow. How are they going to react to this strange teaching, this uncomfortable teaching? Well, the final point tells us there is a response, a reaction of conflict. And there's a threefold reaction we read in these verses. And Luke's conclusion, three responses. And I guess wherever the scriptures are taught, those three responses are always there. First of all, some of them openly rejected Paul's teaching. Verse 32. Some of them sneered. Nonsense. Doesn't fit in with our mindset. Doesn't fit in with our understanding. Therefore, forget it. And there are many people today who say, how can a God do this, that and the other? It's not the sort of God I want to worship. Well, God doesn't fit our understanding. He's above it. And so they sneered and they rejected him. Secondly, some put off the decision, saying, we'll get back to you later. We want to hear you again. And again, in a church service like this, or people who will attend on a fairly frequent occasions, because they find it interesting, but it only ever affects the mind. It's knowledge, it's interesting knowledge, but the demands it makes are too costly. And then there's the third response, those who believed. Again, verse 34. Some of the people became followers of Paul and believed. One of whom was Dionysus, a member of the Areopagus Council. We might say someone very important. He was a council member. That's where he gets the name check. But also liked a woman named Damaris and a number of others. Who's this woman, Damaris? Just a nobody. But Paul says, hey, there's an important person in society and a nobody. But actually, they both get a name check because they're both important to God. Individuals who respond. And of course, every week in churches, individuals respond to the preaching of the message. Some will believe and put their faith in Christ. And we're told, and a number of others. I wonder this morning, which of those three responses describe us? Unbelief, interested, but not yet, or faith. Let's pray.